Hey guys, this is Ishai Breslauer and welcome to the CRE Shark Eye Show, where we discuss commercial real estate. On Mondays, we dive deep into an asset class, and on Thursdays, we go into some inspirational stories for the weekend. Can't wait to start. Let's go. Hey guys, before we continue, I would like to introduce you to the 7-Day CRE Challenge, which will introduce you to commercial real estate and will show you that anyone can do this. Also, I have the free cheat sheet for commercial real estate with the 6 best secrets for commercial real estate. You can download it free. Just click below or above, wherever it is, and get it. Let's continue. Hi, guys. How are you? Ishai Breslauer with the CRE Shark Eye Show. Hope you guys are doing fantastic. Today, we have Neil Greenbaum. A treat because we're going to talk about law and commercial real estate and real estate, about a lot of stuff. But first of all, Neil, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure is all ours, as we call it. We're going to learn a lot today. So, you know what? Before we start diving deep into the story of, you know, who's Neil Greenbaum, how you started up in real estate, how you got excited about this, beautiful business that we love so much. What do you do? Let's start with the elevator pitch, as we call. What do you do today?
What do I do today? So my practice is twofold. I do, I'm a transactional attorney. I handle a lot of commercial real estate and a lot of corporate transactions. So today we're closing on something. I got my lien search in. I ordered the phase one. I have doing a warehouse closing. I have a closing tomorrow. I just helped somebody buy a business in North Carolina yesterday. I don't go to court. The way I'm dressed, this is the way I dress every day. So you're well dressed. Had I known you were so well dressed, I might have thought of that differently.
No, I'll tell you. You know, sometimes it's more casual. Sometimes with the trying to make it colorful. You know, every time a different type of a look. But in general, that's the way it is. But I love it. I love your take on it.
And it's funny, you know, everybody's virtual now because of COVID. But I've been virtual for like 7 years. I have a very big traveling schedule. I travel between 2 states and everything I have is in the cloud. Everything's my laptop. Everything's wire, e-signatures, credit cards. So, I'm old school when it comes to reviewing documents. I'll print out a document, I'll review it, then it gets shredded and trashed. So I have no docs, but I handle things all over wherever they are. And every day something different, but it's all has to do with writing and buying and selling and drafting and that kind of stuff.
Amazing. Well, we have a lot to talk about. You know what? Let's start diving back. What got you to get into real estate, law and real estate? How did it all start for you?
Oh, easy. I didn't want to go to medical school, so I had no choice. In my family, you got to do something. So, I have 2 older cousins who are doctors. I have another couple of cousins who are doctors. I was the first person in my family first grandchild in my family not to go to medical school, actually. So I went to law school. But I was always like a history and English person, much more than a science and math person. So that made a lot more sense for me.
Sounds
then,
cool.
When I was in law school, I'm not a fighter. I mean, a lot of my good friends and family might say that's not true, but I don't like fighting professionally, put it that way. So like, I'd rather just do deals. So I'm not a litigator. I just feel like I'd rather help people buy things, sell things, put things together, make ventures, etc. And it just works out a lot better for me that way.
Sounds the best. But what did you have another thought, like real estate, maybe another thing, or real estate was like a passion that you wanted to go after?
So, I mean, I have some real estate in the family. My grandfather was in real estate. He was a dry cleaner who figured out like he shouldn't just live in an apartment. He should actually own the building. And that's what he did. And, so he was in real estate and it's kind of in the blood. I have a history of real estate myself. I did a lot of condo conversions personally in Florida in the good old days before 2007, 2008, 2009, when everything crashed. So I always gravitated towards transactional things, be it real estate or corporate. Real estate is, in the circles in which we travel, let's put it that way, a lot of people in real estate, that's what people do. So I gravitated towards that.
Tell me something. Well, today, that's what you do. You do commercial real estate. How do you help people? And we spoke a little bit about, you know, right before we started, you spoke about the process. how, and we all are very familiar about the process, especially in commercial real estate, you have to really be familiar with the process. Can you walk us through a little bit about the, you know, on the process and how a guy like you can help anyone who is in the business? That would be great to hear.
Right. So I people go, when do I hire you? I'm like, you hire me in the beginning. You hire me before you do anything. Don't wait until you sign the contract. That's for sure. Hire me when you make an offer. And then sometimes it's an LOI, a letter of intent. So when it comes to commercial property, a lot of brokers like letters of intent because even though they feel comfortable, they feel they're going to get their commission if they have a letter of intent signed. Okay. But a letter of intent is not a contract. It's an agreement to agree. And it's always subject to a formal contract. But I would say to people, hire me early on. I'm not being selfish. I want your money, but it's the right thing to do in the process. So you hire me before you do the LOI. And then we make sure that the LOI has things. And if the LOI is written well, it will make the contract process that much easier because then you'll be able to just point to the LOI and put everything into the contract. So what the usual steps that it is LOI, the price should be negotiated beforehand. Then you do the LOI. You have X amount of time for the contract to be drafted. Usually the seller's attorney will draft the contract. Then we review the contract. We make sure that there are, you know, some important things in there. The purchase price is right. There should be a due diligence period. We have sufficient time if there's financing involved, sufficient time for closing, sufficient time during due diligence to do inspection, engineering, phase one environmental, order title, order survey. If let's say it's multifamily, you're gonna have a lot of tenants or office have a lot of tenants. So you have to review leases, check it against the rent roll, see what your turnover is. There's a lot that goes into a real estate transaction. It's funny, like you see everyone now is like, I'm in real estate. And I always ask, well, what do you do? Because a lot goes into real estate, even buying like, you know, let's say a 10 family multifamily. It's not a large part, you know, purchase necessarily, but there are 10 units. Hopefully they're all occupied. You're gonna have to look at 10 leases. You have to see, like, you don't wanna buy a piece of property and find out you have 10 tenants, like their leases are ending in 1 to 3 months and you have a high turnover rate in that area. Cause then you're gonna have to re-tenant the building and it costs money to re-tenant things. You have to repaint, you might have to do appliances, you might have to fix things. So a lot goes in, and also because I have a real estate background as well as legal background, I'm helpful when it comes to a lot of that that background, that due diligence stuff.
So first of all, you know what, now that you've mentioned like tons of stuff in like a few sentences,
I know. I just realized, like, I could talk the whole 60 minutes, and you don't have to do anything. You can leave the room, and I'll just keep. I'm joking.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I'm just kidding, but I'm saying, let's dive deep a little bit, you know, into each and every topic. A person got an LOI, into a contract. What are the things that you would point out in any deal that are a breaker? And, you know, let's talk a little bit about the issues in the contract. And there's so many things in the contract, from, you know, from the legal stuff to the divisions in terms of the timing, due diligence process, in terms of the, you know, the timing that everything is being designed in the contract, is being pointed out in the contract. What are the things that you would, you know, point out?
I mean, listen, I mean, all right, let's say price is always, you know, locked in beforehand. So timing is so important. I see people get caught not having enough time to close.
What is enough time?
You know what?
Let's stop on that. So, sorry, I'm stopping you.
No problem. If you're buying commercial property, I always like 30 days due diligence and then 30 days to close. That's 60 days. Maybe even more if you can get it. Now, a lot of sellers, especially in today's market, look, we're in a seller's market today. So sellers are, I mean, what they're asking for nowadays is, you know, hard money at contract, you know. They want shortened periods. They want no financing contingencies, or at least, you know, shortened financing contingencies. It's a seller's market. So if you want to buy, you have to jump through hoops a lot of times. I think that, and I see it a lot, and I always put in provisions. Let's say you have 30 days due diligence and 30 days close thereafter. I always try to negotiate an extra 30 days. We'll put down more money. We're already hard. Our deposit's already hard at that point. So we'll put down more money hard and get extra time if we need it. Look, you never know. Sometimes things happen. Sometimes, you know, a phase, it's funny. So like I do a lot of deals and I do deals all over the country, but in Florida now, it's a hot market. If you want to get a phase one environmental study done in Florida, I mean, you're gonna wait 3 weeks for it now. That's a long time. So if you don't order it day one, let's say you have a 20 day due diligence period, you might not even get it done if you order it the day of contract. So I tell people all the time, like I say to the seller, listen, in today's environment, your 15 day due diligence period is just not reasonable. You know, I can't even order the things in time. Title, survey takes so long in Florida right now. It's amazing. So what we do is we rush things. If you're buying, you're going to pay extra to rush it because surveyors can be incentivized by money. You know, they'll work harder if you pay them. So I always find people get caught with timing. So it's very important that regardless of what the type of deal, be it multifamily, office, warehouse, whatever, industrial, that you have timing on due diligence. Due diligence takes a long time nowadays because people are behind the eight ball, and that if you're financing it, things always arise, that you have enough time to finance it. So I always get 60 to 90 days. Listen, if you're selling a property, I know you want the money yesterday, but sometimes it does take 60 to 90 days. I could do 60, 90 is better. 30 is almost impossible, depending on the situation. I've done less. I'll tell you a quick story. I'm sorry. We had a warehouse deal. We closed on a warehouse in Miami recently, and we were supposed to get 80% financing from a lender. And in the end, the lender offered 70% financing. I'm like, that doesn't work. We can't come out of pocket 10% more. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. So we went to a bridge lender to give us a short term 1 year loan. We closed the loan in 7 days. I mean, we had a lot of the stuff ready, survey, title, et cetera, but we negotiated the documents and got it done. So sometimes you can do it, you know, but that was a special situation. We already had a lot of the due diligence behind us, but at the last minute, the bank decided not to give 80% financing, like, even though that's what the original letter from the bank said. You know, they changed their mind. So these contingencies happen all the time. So you always have to make sure that you have sufficient time. And in that contract, I had negotiated for extra time. We put extra money down and we got an extra 30 days. So thankfully we were able to get the bridge loan and close it.
Sounds good. But tell me something, how much, when you say hard money, how much is it today? If you have to compare today versus, let's say, pre-COVID, how is it? How much money down?
Same thing. In my mind, like, I mean, it depends on the purchase price, obviously, right? But like, if you're, let's say you're buying something for $5 million, you're putting down $250 at contract and $250 at the end of due diligence. It's going to be hard 10% going in. So if you need extra time, I would offer. Yeah, I mean, obviously it's the client's money. I don't just offer money without checking, but I would offer I'd offer an extra $50,000 to $100,000 or more to get the extra time if you need it. You're already $500,000. Hard to put an extra $50,000 or $100,000 you need to close the deal. It's worth it. Or you're at the five anyway.
What is a break when it comes to the due diligence where you come and tell your clients? Obviously, we know so many stories, but I want to hear from you a little bit from your experience, as we call it, that you told your client we're out.
I will never tell my client we're out. Because as I say to the clients, I don't make those decisions. I'll tell you what the story is, but I'm not taking equity in this property. If I'm not taking equity in this property, I'm not making decisions for you. I mean, they'll ask me for advice and I'll help them, but it's not my deal. And it's funny, like I post on LinkedIn a lot, and I posted this the other day about, I had a client who hired me to do a multifamily acquisition. And I asked him, did you read the contract? He goes, no, I hired you to read the contract. I'm like, no, listen, I'm gonna read the contract. You got to know your business. This is your business, your deal. You have to know exactly what you're getting into, especially if you have investors, because an investor is going to call you up and going to ask you a question. You're not going to know your deal. You'll never have investors again. So in terms of breaking deals, I don't break deals. I tell clients, I give them my advice. But so what would break a deal? What would break a deal is, I mean, obviously something environmental that we want. If the phase one comes back, there's bad environmental, we got to do a phase two. It might not be worth it depending on the circumstances. Obviously, if the rent rolls and the leases don't match and they're different ballparks, that's not going to work. I really don't break deals. What I do is I try to say, okay, we have a problem. I tell the other party, we have a problem. We have to figure out what to do. We might need more time. We're going to get the deal done. It's not like a personal track record is on the back of my baseball card, but I have a very good record in terms of deals not breaking apart. It doesn't benefit anybody if a deal breaks. Nothing happens. No one makes money when deals break.
You know what? I love what you're saying now, because from my end, you know, when we make a deal, you want an attorney that will be a deal maker and not a deal breaker, meaning you have millions of ways to figure things out and to sort things out. And you want someone to be creative. You have in your team, you want creative people, especially your attorney, obviously on your side. Tell me something. When is the point where you tell, you know, this is something that I love to do. I always love to like analyze that. I always tell people that, you know, deal in commercial real estate, as well as people on my team, et cetera, always tell, if there's just something, when you got stuck, if there's something that cannot be released, as we call it, a core cannot be released, get on the phone together with the attorneys, together with the people involved, and try to get it sorted out, because sometimes that ping pong is, what is your experience with those cases?
Okay, so I refer to LinkedIn already, but I happen to post on LinkedIn a lot, and I always post about things that we're going to bring up because I've posted thousands of times. Okay, so I had this, when I get a contract, you know, a lot of times a lawyer will send out a contract and the other lawyer will redline it in Word and send it back with, like, you know, 1,000 corrections. It looks like a bad test score because there's so much red on it, right? I do not wait for them to send me back another red line. You can go back and forth for a month redlining. Maybe I'm impatient. I am, you know, we see how fast I talk, et cetera. Okay. So what I do is I call the other lawyer immediately and we hash it out in an hour. There's no reason. I don't believe in wasting time. If there's one or two deal points that we can't work out, I'll call the other attorney. You have to get on the phone. There's no reason to go back and forth with red lines. A lot of people like that. Oh, here's my fifth V7, the seventh version of the contract. If you're on the seventh version of the contract, to me, it just doesn't make any sense. Send me a contract, I'll do a red line, I'll call you, we'll go over it on the phone, all the issues there, and then we'll work it out. And it doesn't take, I've heard, you know, horror stories of people like negotiating contracts for weeks or months. It shouldn't take weeks or months if you're picking up the phone. If you pick up the phone, days is all it should take. So I always pick up the phone and I have no problem speaking to the other parties and hashing out what we need to hash out. If we let things go and waste time, it doesn't benefit anybody.
For sure. 100%. Tell me something. When it comes to financing, your experience, what is the requirement? Where do you come into play when it comes to the financing? And what is the bank demanding in terms of the legals that you could usually come in and help out?
Okay, I mean, look, they're going to want all the basics we're going to order anyway. Let's say title survey, phase one environmental engineering report. Okay, then they're going to want from an attorney, they're going to want an opinion letter about, because we're going to form a special purpose entity, you know, that only owns the property and has no other assets, so there can't be any other liabilities. They're going to want an opinion letter from me about that entity. They're going to want, you know, assignment assumption of leases, assignment assumption of rents, a security deposit. I mean, there's a million legal documents depending on the type of asset that you're dealing with that banks are very careful. I understand they're lending money. Lending money is a dangerous game, you know, but they usually paper these deals sufficiently and they have enough lawyers. It's amazing, depending on the size of the lender. We did on that deal that we did in a week, that bridge loan, it was 7 days from start to finish. The lender had a large law firm with four separate lawyers in three separate locations working on the deal. I mean, their legal fee was ridiculous and my client had to pay it, but I did negotiate it down. But anyway, it's, you know, they take care of themselves, the bank. They know exactly what they want. They have their lists and their lists are long. The first thing you'll ask for, what I ask for when I'm dealing with a lender's account, so give me a closing checklist. I need a checklist of everything that I need to handle to make this deal close. And I want it day one. If I have it day one, I know exactly what I'm getting into. So usually there are no surprises with the banks once you get that checklist, but they do have a laundry list of items that they're going to want from me, and they are well protected.
100%. Tell me something. When you check the rent roll versus the lease, that's an interesting topic. What are the things that you're going to, like, sort of dive deep into when you're going to tell your client, listen, this is something that we'll have to look into and this is not, et cetera?
So, I mean, look, it all depends what I'm hiring for. Like, I tell people, I'll do whatever you want, I'll do a la carte. A lot of people do like me to get involved in the due diligence process. So when you deal with certain, if you're buying industrial property with one tenant, it's not hard. It's one lease, okay. If you're buying off or multifamily, that's where you're going to have the most tenants, office and multifamily. So, I mean, look, if you're buying, you know, a 100-unit multifamily, you're going to have 100 leases. So you're going to get a rent roll report. You're going to see what, you don't have to go through the lease, but I always say you should at least have somebody match up the leases to the rent roll report, because I can make a rent roll report up. I can make it up and then you're going to rely on it. I mean, yes, I'm going to make a representation warranty that this is what it is, but it's always worth checking. I mean, there are companies out there that will abstract it and do it for you as well. And office leases, it's the same thing. If you can have 30 different tenants, you don't want to find, especially with office leases, because you don't want to find out that the tenants, you have like 40% of your leases coming due next year and none of them renewing, because that's not how you make money in office, okay? In multifamily, it's different. You can finding tenants a lot easier. You know, you're probably your average occupancy rates for multifamily are over 90% anyway. But still, you want to make sure that it's as close to 100 as possible and that you know exactly when things are coming offline. So if you have, sometimes it takes a week or two or three to get a new unit ready for a renter. So you want to know exactly what your process is. Look, I have experience in real estate, not only as a lawyer, so I know how it works. I've bought multifamily before. So it's important. You can't just buy, the rent roll looks good, let's buy it. No, the rent roll looks good, but then in 6 months from now, you have a totally different rent roll. So you have to just know what the future is bringing, and you can see it in the documents.
There's not the issue with that. When it comes to concessions, for example, right? Sometimes you have leases that could be problematic. What would be a lease that would be a problematic lease? Regardless of the unmatching, matching, you know, with a rent roll. Something in the lease that you would say, oops, this is not good.
Yeah, prepaid rents on a multifamily. If a tenant prepaid 6 months rent, you know, that's a problem. Because even if you, look, you're going to prorate it with the seller. If the seller collected 6 months in advance, you're going to prorate it, but still it's going to affect your cash flow. Because remember, in real estate cash flow, especially multifamily, that's a cash flow business, you know? So you want to make sure that your rents are coming in every month. So prepaid rents are a problem. In terms of concessions on multifamily, it's not as bad as an office. And office concessions can be very bad, depending on what was negotiated. I mean, you know.
Can you give an example?
You want to make sure, like if you have an office building that is CAM, you know, common area maintenance charges, that they're paying their percentage of what they have to for that, including, you know, insurance taxes, et cetera. Sometimes, you know, you have, not every operator is good as every other operator. A lot of way to make money in real estate is by being a better operator than the person you're buying from. If they weren't a good operator, then you just by buying the property and operating better, you can make money. There can be more value in the property. So, for example, a lot of landlords, and they're smart people and they're wealthy people that just, they have terrible leases. They wrote them themselves. They do things like that. So they'll give concessions. They won't write about CAM. There's no CAM in this lease. Well, if no CAM in this lease, this person's not paying CAM. And if this person has 8% of your building, you have a problem. There's a shortfall. And now what are we doing? Oh, guess what? The landlord's going to have to cover it. Well, we have to know that there's X amount of time left on that lease. When that lease is ready for renewal, either they're getting a brand new lease, obviously, or we're going to find a new tenant. So you have to make sure that, you know, the operator, even if it's a good building, right location, right this, et cetera, and everything else lines up, a lot of times it's not run well, or they have bad documents, they have bad leases. So that's why I think it's important, especially when it comes to, say, office or industrial. We have, you know, multifamily, the leases are usually 1 year or less, and they turn over at, you know, the attrition rate is pretty high. So you want to make sure when it comes to, say, office or industrial, that you read those leases and know exactly what you're getting into. Because I tell people all the time, if you have a better lease, you make more money. So if there's room to make money on just the lease itself, because the seller wasn't doing something right, I mean, that's how you make money. Everyone has their own way of doing real estate. And I just feel that the best way to make money in real estate is by adding value. You know, a lot of times you can add value with the same tenants. Maybe the lease isn't good or you know, it's coming up for renewal. Well, guess what? Now I'm going to throw in camera. I'm going to raise this, or this isn't, or they weren't paying for this, or it happens all the time. And that's why to me, due diligence is usually the most important part of the process. It's not like, oh, I like the building, I like the location. Well, that's great. You know, that's like meeting somebody who's very attractive, but they're a horrible person. You don't know until after you start talking to them. They look from afar. Oh, that person looks great. Well, that building looks great, but when we go into due diligence, we can find out how horrible it is.
Tell me something. Between all these asset classes that you deal with, because you deal with different asset classes, what is the thing that you could point out as, wow, this has a different process than this one because of something? Like, for example, I would say phase one, environmental, I would call it, in industrial. What could you point out in terms of the differences? Maybe that and maybe other differences that you have experienced?
I trend more towards multifamily than anything else, just because that's what my background personally is in. Industrial is a whole different animal. You know, usually you have a lot less tenants, you have far more environmental issues. You have to really be careful about your environmental representations, warranties, and indemnities, because especially if they're, you know, manufacturing something or they're storing something there, there's far more possibility for a problem. You have to make sure that your insurance knows what they're doing, because you want to, like if I'm buying an industrial property and they're warehousing chemicals, or they have manufacturing, even light manufacturing, it still might have some toxicity there. I'm telling you, I want to make sure I'm insured. Because if you don't tell your insurance, like your insurance broker doesn't know. So you better tell them, because if you buy a policy that doesn't cover certain environmental or, you know, issues like that, like you're done. You're going to write a very big check if something happens. And the whole point is avoiding, is not only trying to create value and make money, but avoid the downside. Sometimes make more money avoiding the downside.
Tell me something. Let's move to for a second to, you know, structuring actually the whole legal structure, because, you know, entering a deal, you have this flow chart with all those different LLCs and all those different things. How can you, when you want to simplify it to your client, because sometimes as we call it, the end user who's coming to acquire property, he's seeing all these, the tree of LLCs, as we call it, or whatever, the flow chart or whatever it is. It could be really confusing of who's who and what is what. Give us a little bit of your take on how to simplify it and to make it vivid, clear.
I'm not such a big fan of having the trees, honestly. And a lot of my clients don't do that. And personally, I've been involved in that in the past. I did a lot of condo development. So we had like the acquiring company, the management company, and this, and then, you're right, and you know, it was a family tree. I don't tend to do that much anymore. Look, we always form, you know, single or special purpose entity for acquisition, and depending on the deal, like a lot of people, they own the deal themselves, or they have their own holding company that owns the deal, or maybe they'll raise money and they'll form something else. So like, it's possible you could have five owners, you know, but I simplify it in the sense that we have the company, the entity in title, and then maybe there's a holding company, and then the holding company could have maybe five owners or something. But I try not to break. I mean, I've seen things that are absurd. We have like 40 branches coming out. I mean, that's going to be on a really big, complex deals. Not that I shy away from those, but I'm just not a big fan of that. It makes, you know, I like to keep things simple. And I think buying a $100 million, you know, portfolio of multifamily and buying, you know, let's say, you know, a $10 million building, the structure is the same. It's basically the same process. I mean, a little more complicated, or you have to do, you know, a few more things, but I always try to keep things simple. And some people like to complicate things. I'm not a tax person personally. Like, I always send people out for tax advice, but tax people like to structure things like trees, you know, so they have their reason. So I say, rely on them. If that's what they want, we can do it. But it's just not my, it's not my way of thinking.
Well, you know, you can complicate things and you can make them simple, as we call that.
Right.
Yeah, that's the way it is. You know, in real estate, you can have all kind of structures, all kind of deals. Tell me something. Do you have a cool story, you know, out of the head, you could just tell us a little bit about something, an experience that you had maybe recently, different type of things that are going on in the market today? They could point out.
You know, it's funny. I'm in a deal now that hopefully will close today, tomorrow. There's no contract. There was a lease and there was an option to purchase under the lease. There was a rider with an option to purchase. It was written very poorly and I was not involved at the time. I was brought in only a month ago when the option was going to be exercised. So under this, the lease is ending the end of this month, and we had until the end of the month to exercise the option. Then we had 30 days to close. The seller did not want the option to be exercised. Why? Because the option price from a year ago is now 30% below market. And the seller would rather keep the property and put it on the market and make 30% more. And I completely understand that. The problem is you gave an option under a lease. Okay.
Right.
So when I called, there was two option payments to be made. There was an initial option payment, and there was an option payment upon the issuance of the CO, because there was work done to the property. The CO has not been issued. So I called the attorney who drafted the lease, and I said, well, what do we do about the second payment? Because there's no CO issued, and I think the CO is a condition precedent to the payment, which means that we don't have to pay the payment if there's no CO. So the seller didn't want us to exercise the option. So what the seller's attorney did is, well, your client emailed me last week about buying the property, so we deem that as exercising the option. I'm like, we didn't exercise the option. We still have a few weeks to do it. They're going to know we deem that you exercise the option 10 days ago, you now have 20 days to close. But they have no CO, open permit, we have no contract, we have nothing, right? So the date that we're supposed to close is today, okay? As of last week, we didn't know what to do. So then I ordered title, survey, quick, rushed everything, paid through the nose, because that's what you have to do in today's environment if you really want things fast. We hired a litigator, because in case.
Yeah.
And what we did is we blindsided the seller. The seller thought today's going to come and, you know, we're not going to close, and they're going to keep the property and put it on the market for 30% more. What happened instead is I drafted all the seller's documents. I drafted the deed. I drafted the conveyance documents. I had everything ready with the title company. And on Monday, we contacted the seller and we said, we're ready to close on Thursday. We're ready, willing, and able. Here's the title report. Here's your mortgages. Get payoffs. And I think they realized that even though, listen, I'm not a litigator. They could have litigated it. They could have afforded it out. There's a lot on the table. You're talking about millions of dollars when you're talking about 30% of the value of something. But we're closing today or tomorrow. I actually got the lawyer to push to tomorrow if we need it. So what happened is it was a poorly written option. We basically called their bluff. They didn't think we'd ever close. We did far more than we had to do. I did the seller's job because I didn't want him to drag his feet drafting documents. I'm like, here's everything. Here's the title. Here's your documents. Review them. Here's, like, we're ready to close in 3 days, and we're closing. And that's, I mean, look, it's a rabbit out of a hat. It's a mace, right? A miracle. But, like, it's going to happen. It's done. Like, that's it. The seller's deed is signed. The title company has it. We're closing in escrow. I have until tomorrow, 5:00. I think we can do it today. Get it over. But That's most times it doesn't happen. The litigators get involved and 6 months later, everyone's out, you know, fortune and money. But this one, thankfully, is working.
And you know what? That's the voice of experience, as we call it. We, you know, when you find something that got stuck and you're saying, okay, I know how to get it unstuck and to move forward.
Listen, in this situation, I understand the seller. They're upset because they're going to make less money. But you know what? You know what? You had this deal that you arranged a year ago. So you had this deal you arranged a year ago, and this is business. You know, sometimes you grant an option and you lose out, or the market, sometimes the market turns against you and the option is good. And either they exercise it or they don't exercise it. This is a business. We can't tell the future. If I could tell the future, I'd be doing a lot of other things. That's what I say, you know?
Tell me something, talking about the future, not in the past. You see the clients coming to you, and you're looking at the markets also for yourself, I'm assuming. What do you think today about the market, especially as a guy who's between the two states?
It's hot. I mean, the real estate market's hot. Look at how things have happened over the past year. So it's funny. So I was buying things in Florida 20 years ago, before everyone got to Florida. It's not true. Florida's been around for hundreds of years, right? But 20 years ago is different. Like, you didn't see 10 guys on a plane. You didn't see 10 guys. I'm gonna be pejorative. You didn't see 10 guys from Brooklyn on a plane together going down to Florida to buy property. That's what you see all the time now. Nobody did that 20 years ago. So 20 years ago, and then all of a sudden, like 2004, 5, 6, 7, every week, new guys from New York come down to buy Florida. Like, something's wrong. The market was going crazy. And look what happened. I mean, I'm not saying that's what caused the market to go down, but look what happened. I mean, we had we had this terrible economic crisis. Real estate got rocked. I think with most people, depending on when you got into real estate, you know, they haven't seen down markets. Let's not talk about COVID. COVID is an aberration. Okay, it's a once in a century aberration. They haven't seen down markets. 2008 was a down market. Early 1990s was a down market. Mid 1970s was a down market. You know, so there have been down. I professionally, I've seen two down markets. You know, real down markets. So a lot of people, you know, I'm in real estate. I'm buying a property. And if I buy the property, it'll be worth more in X amount of years. Well, maybe it will, maybe it won't. A lot of things happen. And also, when you want to get out, it might not be worth more. It might be in the middle of depression. Who knows what's going to happen? So I think the market now is very hot. I don't tell people not to buy the top of the market because I hope it's the top of the market, right? Because if I say, it's too high, I'm not buying, you know, then what, next year it's 30% more. Well, guess what? We screwed up. There's a famous, I saw it for the first time like 25 years ago on the back of a broker's card. It was a broker from Arizona, from Phoenix, I remember. It was a picture of like a decrepit old man, like with a cane and tattered clothing. And it said, the young man who waited for the price of real estate to come down. Okay, so the point is, I don't know what high means. Are the prices higher now than they were a year ago? Yeah.
Right.
But does that mean that they're going
to be... That's when the crystal ball comes into play. We don't know.
Well, exactly. I don't... Right. So what you do is, I tell people, you do it on a deal-by-deal basis. You find a property that it makes sense. The numbers work. You have value you can add that you can increase. You're not holding it. You're not looking at, oh, I'm going to get out of this in 12 to 24 months. You know, so then you're not doing a short-term play. I don't think real estate is a short-term play. Not that, I mean, you can flip things, but it's not a short-term play. So then I think it's worth buying. I had a great aunt. My grandparents were in real estate. My grandmother's sisters were in real estate. I had a great aunt. My great aunt Shirley, who probably passed away 25 years ago, she used to say as a kid, I can make you a millionaire in real estate, but you have to wait till you're 70. That's what she said, because it's a long game. That's not necessarily true, obviously. But it's a long game. You'll see it's a long game, you know? So I'm not saying people don't get into it and get lucky. I've seen it happen. They get out quickly, but you have to have a long-term frame of mind when you get into something. That's where I look at it. And if you do, and even if the market is 30% higher now than last year, it shouldn't matter, because you're not playing it, you know, for the short term.
100%. Neil, want to thank you.
Listen, I bought a house. I bought a new house. Listen, yeah, I bought a new house 2.5 years ago in Florida. Okay, I moved 2.5 years ago. The house is worth 70% more than I paid for it 2.5 years.
Ridiculous!
It's insanity.
Yeah,
it's crazy. Am I selling? No, because I have a use for it. Is it going to be worth less next year? Maybe. Is it worth more next year? I don't know. But it's a long. I didn't buy the house for 2 years. I bought the house for like 30 years, maybe.
Exactly.
But you know, it's like, so that was my frame of mind. It's profits on paper. Don't confuse profits on paper with profits. They're not the same thing.
100%. Neil, I want to thank you. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
You guys.
What is that?
Did I talk too much?
No.
Did I talk too
much? You're perfect. You're perfect. And by the way, you guys that are listening to the show and seeing Neil, you need a real estate attorney. You need a commercial real estate attorney. You need someone to help you with the acquisitions. Check out the links above and below. Wherever you are, and I wish you guys take care. I'll see you on the next show. Hey guys, thanks for joining me in this CRE Shark Eye show. I hope you enjoyed it. And go subscribe, download, do whatever you guys need to do. And I'll see you in the next episode. Take care of yourselves.